When President Biden proposed free community college during his address to Congress last month, he gave voice to an idea that many have already been working on.
A college degree is now really beyond the reach of a middle-class family.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, an in-depth look at the free college movement. We'll also spend an academic minute gaining trust with a smile. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. College is expensive, really expensive, and I suspect you did not need me to tell you this. And it is a problem as more jobs are demanding a college degree. So what if college was free? There's a growing movement in the U.S. that thinks it should be. That's what Michelle Miller Adams writes about in her new book called The Path to Free College, in pursuit of access, equity, and prosperity. Dr. Miller Adams is a professor of political science at Grand Valley State University and a senior researcher at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Michigan. I asked her why she took on this project. Why talk about free college?
So, like a lot of your listeners, I imagine, I grew up at a time when a university degree was affordable for someone who is in the middle class. My parents could send my brother and me to public university in California on their very middle-class salaries without incurring a lot of student loan debt. And if a student was from a low-income background, they had access to Pell Grants that would cover most of the cost of the full cost of attendance of a four-year college. And as your listeners all know, that has changed a lot. And now student loan debt, the need to borrow for a four-year degree and even some two-year degrees is really high. The average student graduating with any student loan debt has something like $37,000 in debt. And Pell Grants have failed to keep up with increases in the price of college. So over the past 15 years or so, about 200 communities and community colleges and a growing number of states, I think we're up to about 20, have experimented with ways of offering their residents a tuition-free path to higher education. Sometimes we call these place-based scholarships or promise scholarships. And I have been down in the weeds with these programs for about 15 and a half years now, studying them, working with people who evaluate them, helping communities design them. And it seemed like the right time to step back and take a higher level look at how we got here. What is going on in society that brought us to what we can call this free college moment?
But free college, as you point out, is not really a new idea, is it?
It's not a new idea at all. In fact, it's a return to earlier periods in U.S. history when a higher education was affordable. When my parents went to the University of California in the 1950s, it was tuition free. Not every state had tuition free college. California was probably the one state with the biggest tuition free college commitment that ran across all levels of public colleges and universities in the state. But in other states, public institutions were affordable until 1970s, about when we started to have this really dramatic, inexorable rise in tuition. I think tuition has rates over that time frame have gone up about 300%. Part of the reason that we're having this conversation does have to do with the price of college, but there are other reasons as well. And one of the things that I do in this book is try to disentangle the multiple reasons why states and communities have gotten into this free college business. And often these are not clearly set out by the stakeholders in these programs, and it's useful to disentangle them. So in the book, I outlined three different rationales for the tuition-free college movement. And I think it's important to say that we're not really talking about free college. None of these programs, either at the state or the local, or even especially proposals at the national level, actually take care of all of the costs of college. We're really talking about tuition-free. Most of these programs will cover tuition and mandatory fees at the higher ed institutions that they cover. The three rationales that I lay out, and they're actually in the book's title, the subtitle is In Pursuit of Access, Equity, and Prosperity. So the first rationale, access, has to do with this rising price of college and the fact that a college degree is now really beyond the reach of a middle-class family and requires these very high levels of student loan debt, or also students who work full time while they're in college, with a lot of implications for the economy as well as for the students themselves. The second rationale has to do with equity concerns, because even as more and more of the U.S. population has enrolled in some kind of post-secondary education or training, degrees are distributed very unequally along racial and economic lines in our society, as are many other things. So decades of effort to expand that post-secondary pipeline to include low-income, first-generation Black and Latino students have been really only marginally successful. So some of these promise programs, these scholarship programs, are driven by an effort, an explicit equity rationale to try to reach low-income, first-generation communities of color. The third rationale that I talk about in the book, the subtitle refers to it as prosperity, but it really has to do with employment. There is a strong drive right now to ensure that businesses have access to a skilled workforce and that U.S. workers have the skills they need to be successful in the 21st century economy. So this workforce employment rationale, we can call it, is really important. And it's what's brought about tuition-free college programs in places where you might not expect them, like in the state of Tennessee, which has two very robust statewide tuition-free college programs. And it's a very Republican and conservative state, and yet they've invested heavily in these programs. I think I also throughout try to offer what you could kind of call a collective goods or a public good argument for making higher education free, or at the very least affordable. Higher education degrees and credentials, and we're not just talking about, you know, bachelor's degrees here, we're talking about all kinds of certifications, credentials, associate degrees, other kinds of high value training programs. They have what I would call both a public face and a private face. They benefit the individuals who hold those degrees or credentials, but they also benefit society. They help communities be more competitive. They help employers meet their needs. They have public benefits that go beyond the benefit that just accrues to the individual earning the degree or credential.
And aren't there some employers that want to move into places that are kind of demanding you have to give us a better educated workforce?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the top items on the list of large corporations in their site selection process when they're trying to figure out where to make a major investment or put in a new facility is they look at the quality of the public education system in that area, and they look at the percentage of workers in the community who have some kind of degree or credential. So increasingly, it's critical, again, not just for individuals to be successful, but for communities and states to be successful, to have that investment in higher education.
Is there really a political will to do this nationwide, or is this just going to be a state and locality type thing?
So that's a great question. I think there is, but the answer, as with a lot of things in national politics these days, is it depends. And it depends on the kind of coalition that can be assembled behind a particular type of free college program. during the 2020 presidential campaign, the president had actually committed to two separate free college programs. One, a universal tuition-free program for community colleges and, those shorter-term training programs. And the other, a tuition-free commitment to make public colleges and universities, including four-year universities, tuition-free for families up to $125,000. And that grew out of course, advocacy from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and the work of Bernie Sanders, his College for All bill. And what it looks like is that for now, at least, the Biden administration is going ahead with the more, let's call it the more modest plan of the two-year programs only. It's a less expensive plan. And it's a plan that ties in more directly to some of those workforce concerns that you've just raised. As such, it has the potential to assemble a coalition behind it that can ensure that it is enacted into law. At the moment, last time I checked, there were three free college bills that had been introduced in Congress, but one of them is this two-year community college program. I should add that along with that commitment, the Biden administration is committing to provide more generous support for historically Black colleges and universities and other minority-serving institutions in line with its lens of promoting racial justice in all of its policies. So there's more in these proposals than just free community college. Happily, there is also some money for these community colleges to experiment and apply these support programs that help first-generation students be successful in college once they get there, because we're not talking about a program where we just want to send more people to college. We want to make sure they pick the right kind of post-secondary program and that they are able to complete it. That's what's going to bring value to them and to employers and the broader community.
One of the more inelegant arguments I hear against this is, hey, I paid my tuition, so you should pay yours.
You are absolutely right. That is heard often and it is inelegant. Yes, that is an argument that you do hear a lot. It's important to point out that if you are anyone other than a very young person and you did pay for your tuition, you were paying much lower rates of tuition than what students are paying for today. There are a bunch of calculations out there. I don't have them at my fingertips, but there are calculations around, how many hours you would have had to work at a minimum wage job to afford average college tuition at a public institution in the 70s or the 80s versus today. And by any measure, the rate of increase in the cost of tuition has been so high that comparing your tuition rates of even maybe 15, 20 years ago to what people are paying today is not really a fair comparison. On top of that, you really do need to add this lens of where we are in the 21st century economy, where it's not just a handout to say, we're going to pay for your college. It's actually a pressing economic need for our nation's economic success. After the 2008 recession, something like 99% of the jobs that were created in the years of growth following that recession required some kind of post-secondary training or education. And so increasingly, and nothing's going to change with the jobs of the future, to have a workforce that is making its contribution to our economic success, we need to make sure that college is affordable and accessible.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Michelle Miller Adams about the free college movement continues. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Guys, Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest is Dr. Michelle Miller Adams, a professor of political science at Grand Valley State University in Michigan and a senior researcher at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo. We're talking about the free college movement and her new book, The Path to Free College, in Pursuit of Access, Equity, and Prosperity. I asked Dr. Miller Adams to think about if she could design a perfect program. Would it be achievement-based or would it be available to all, which may set up less talented students for failure?
That's a loaded question, so I will try to unpack it a little bit. For me, the perfect plan is not achievement-based. If the goal of a plan is to broaden that pipeline, to provide opportunities for upward mobility for communities, populations that have not had access to higher education in the past, and to really enrich the nation's human capital, the pipeline needs to be as open as possible to bring in those new populations. If you put a GPA floor or an attendance requirement or other kinds of hurdles in front of people who need to pass those hurdles to access the scholarship, you're essentially going to screen out many of the people you're trying to serve. However, that being said, it's a terrible idea to set people up for failure in a higher education. And that's why providing guidance to students in high school and to adults who are considering going back for some kind of degree and credential around what is the right fit for them, what kind of post-secondary program should they be pursuing, is absolutely essential. And it tends to get short shrift in these discussions, which tend to focus on money. But let's keep in mind, community colleges are the major provider in the nation of career and technical education. I saw something this morning on Twitter, I guess, that said it was a for-profit college saying, basically, we shouldn't be shut out of this because look, we have trained all these welders. Well, community colleges have trained at least as many welders as the for-profit sector. So career and technical education is very available in our community college sector. And for some people, a very short-term, hands-on, practical, applied credential is going to be a better fit than a more academic path.
When it comes to providing tuition-free college, and we're talking about the U.S. system here, how do we compare with the rest of the world?
That's a really interesting question because it's changed over time. The U.S. higher education system was known for most of the 20th century as a very democratic system, small d democratic, dating back to the GI Bill, which dramatically broadened access to colleges and universities for returning GIs, many of whom came from working class and middle class and lower income backgrounds. The U.S. higher ed system was always known as one that was accessible to much of the U.S. population. Now, did we always make good on that promise? No. Was the GI Bill shaped by racial exclusion? Yes, it was. But it's changed over time. Higher education is much more affordable in Europe, but fewer people were able to take advantage of it. And that has changed. And now college-going rates in Europe are higher than they are here. And that has to do with price, our prices.
Well, you've got to ask this question about almost everything. How has COVID affected this movement?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And it does apply to everything, of course. COVID, I think many people may have seen these statistics. COVID has led to a dramatic drop in college enrollments, especially at the community college level and especially among low-income and racial minority populations. There are very obvious reasons. COVID has been accompanied by a widespread economic crisis that has hurt lower-income families and individuals more than anyone else. The wealthy have kind of done okay through COVID. And of course, it's created crises of childcare and problems with women needing to leave the workforce and people needing to leave college in order to be able to care for their families or make enough money to live. There are also people who didn't relish the thought of virtual learning, and I can't say I blame them. So I think there are a lot of reasons, but there are a lot of troubling signs. If you look at FAFSA filing rates, so filing rates for the application that unlocks Pell Grants, it's down. And so college going is, which had been rising pretty steadily, even in light of our high prices, it has really been tipped into kind of a dangerous place with COVID. So I think the hope of the Biden administration and many free college advocates is that by being able to deliver a simple, clear, early message of college affordability, we'll be able to push as a society against those negative trends that were brought about by the pandemic.
You spoke about how the wealthy are doing just fine, and it reminded me you did mention the 2019 Varsity Blues scandal. You seem to think that that was just, you know, standard operating procedure, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a little beyond standard operating procedure because it was actually illegal and people did go to jail and pay fines as a result of it. But that Varsity Blues scandal, the college admission scandal, I think really brought attention to some practices that have been widespread in the college admission field for many years, and that work to the advantage of more affluent individuals. So maybe, you know, photoshopping your kid's face onto the body of an athlete in an obscure sport isn't done all the time and is illegal, but certainly making sure that your child has had the opportunity to play that obscure sport while in high school and be able to apply as an athlete, or being able to invest in essay writing help or a college application coach, or take admission exams and retake admission exams and take prep courses for admission exams. That's all perfectly legal and standard practice among more affluent families who are in that world of competitive college admission.
So it wasn't that they did it, it's just that they did it poorly.
Yeah, they kind of overdid it, and they did it, you know, they did it as a.
Yeah, so they hatched a caper.
They hatched a caper, right. Those are the words I was looking for. But, you know, it's probably a good opportunity to mention that the free college movement has learned a lot from 15 years of these, I don't really want to call them experiments because they're very embedded, these initiatives at the state and local level. And one of the things that you see, so the school district where I live in Kalamazoo, which has had this Kalamazoo Promise program in place for 15 years, something that's new is that almost every student in the school takes the SAT and the PSAT in school altogether, which is not something that was happening previously. When students take AP courses now, advanced placement courses in Promise communities, the school districts also make sure that they take the tests and they pay for them to take the tests. So that's another way in which these Promise programs catalyze activities that lower the playing field by kind of extending to students who attend these low-income school districts some of the same advantages that more affluent students have provided by their schools or their families.
Well, finally, who's doing it right? Where is there a program that you could point to and they say, if you want to start a free college program, look at how they're doing it over there?
So it depends on how much money you have. There are a lot of places that are doing it right. I love the Kalamazoo example, partly because I'm so familiar with it, but also partly because it is a very generous program. But there are other places that have had fewer resources and have also done a wonderful job. And I'll just mention two of them. Down the highway from us in Detroit, there is a Detroit Promise program that operates on much fewer resources. And they limit attendance to one of six regional community colleges, and they extend that to every high school graduate coming out of the city of Detroit. And I also want to give a shout out to the state of Tennessee. Tennessee built its statewide programs, there are two of them, from knowledge gained from more local programs. It started out as a local program in the Knoxville area and then grew into the Tennessee Promise. And they kept some of the key features of that program. One of them is they have a very large scale mentorship program. Tennessee has taken seriously this idea that students need not just the cost of tuition covered, but they also need some support navigating their way to and through higher education. So it can be done at scale, and it's a much smaller scale program in terms of generosity than the Kalamazoo Promise, but it's had really encouraging effects in the state of Tennessee. And of course, there are many more examples out there.
Again, the name of Dr. Michelle Miller Adams' new book is The Path to Free College, In Pursuit of Access, Equity, and Prosperity. Sometimes the easiest way to build trust is with a smile. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
How do we gain trust in one another? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Ben Ho, associate professor of economics at Vassar College, delves into this question.
Why do babies laugh before they walk? Most mammals are born knowing how to walk, but the laughs and giggles of human newborns will delight sleep-deprived parents long before the babies learn locomotion. One answer is that humans use laughter to build trust, and trust is fundamental to what makes us human. Humans laughed at the unexpected. This explains peekaboo. A baby forgets a person is there when they can no longer see the person's face, and thus they laugh with unexpected delight the instant mom or dad shows up again. We laugh at things that defy expectations. We laugh at jokes that violate shared norms. Therefore, when we meet somebody that laughs at the same things we do, they likely had the same cultural expectations and shared the same norms. Effectively, we have met somebody that we can trust. Nature has embedded a way to gain trust in our biology because trust is so essential to cooperation. We accomplish more working together than alone. But cooperation entails risk, and overcoming risk requires trust. But mechanisms like laughter only really work within small communities. To extend trust to larger groups, humans built new institutions based on religions and around markets and the rule of law. Today, trust permeates the economy, from the banks that hold our money to our relationships at work to the brands we buy. Some of the most important recent innovations, the sharing economy, e-commerce, blockchain, were all based on ideas built around trust. We once scoffed at the idea of sharing a stranger's car or even their house, yet today all that seems normal. The biggest problems our world faces, pandemics, global climate change, all require cooperation and trust at a global scale. Going forward, trust will only become even more central to being human.
That was Ben Ho of Vassar College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.
Thank you.